Hello, and welcome to Lights Up on the Dock, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats, and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. Coming to us live from New York, even though it's not Saturday night.
And not at all live.
Is co-host Alexandra Gellner, aka Alex.
And sitting in front of me in London is co-host Samantha Michka, aka Dr. Sam.
I love how whenever you say my surname now, you always kind of phrase it slightly as a question. Like, am I pronouncing this right? No, I love that.
That's a very American habit, actually. I mean, the way we introduce ourselves, I'm like, Alexandra Gellner?
Is that okay? Am I okay?
Is that
to
okay? I think
orbit?
That's my California, my Valley girl. Coming out.
Of course. How are you doing? How's life?
That's,
how's love? How's the
universe?
That's
such a loaded question. yeah, good. I don't know. It's been a while since, I guess, we've been recording. I think since then, I piled on all the Oscar noms, viewing parties that I could muster, viewing parties with party one myself. and so I'd seen The Brutalist. That's a topic for another time. I saw A Real Pain finally, and highly recommend it. And in terms of theater, I guess I could give a little Birmingham shout out. I managed to go see Streetcar Named Desire. And with the Paul Mescal of Normal People, Gladiator 2 acclaim.
Okay.
But honestly, I kept forgetting he was there, that he was in it, because it was absolutely Patsy Farran's show. She was absolutely brilliant.
Now, if this is the Patsy Farran that I think it is, I saw her in, very unsurprisingly, a Holocaust-related play, Camp Siegfried.
Oh, which was where?
It was at, where was it? It was at the Old Vic here, and it was, I want to say it was about 2 years ago, but what even is time? But you said there's a Birmingham connection. Is that because...
So we slightly crossed paths at the University of Birmingham, so I wondered if you'd know her too, because that's also how we pretty much missed each other too.
It's entirely possible that I may have met her or known of her, but my undergraduate days were not proud or happy times, Alex.
So you decided to redeem yourself by staying for your master's and staying for your PhD.
It's a long story. That's not the story of another time. I suspect it is the same actress, and we will check this in post record and edit. But yeah, sure. Like, she's phenomenal.
So amazing. I mean, I remember seeing her in undergrad when I came for my year abroad, and I came back because I missed everyone so much. I came back for a visit, and I saw her in a student production of History Boys, and even then I was just like, oh man, she's got the groundedness and the gravitas that, you know, legends of the UK stage possess, and she's incredible. So I was like, I have to go see her in this. And yeah, it was incredible. One of the best Blanches I've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
Probably the best.
Oh, damn.
Because it wasn't like the typical approach, you know, that you would see. Like, everyone, Blanche has just become this sort of idea, I think, in the American theater. And it was just entirely her own, just overall. 10 out of 10.
Wow. Okay, that is coming from you. That is high praise. So, you know, full 10 out of 10. I know this word gets used a lot, but the one word that I think to sum up is dynamic. Because she's just constantly, like, she genuinely lives the role. Mm-hmm. But as soon as she steps out onto that stage, she is that character to her fingertips. And, so good. So good.
And being, like, moment to moment, her struggle and her fight really came through in that performance. And it was the first time, I think, a lot of the group that I went with, they were saying, wow, that's the first time I've realized how little Stanley is in the play. And I mean, Tennessee Williams, when he was, first, brought this play about? He said, I have written a play about two sisters. Mm. And this is the first time I think I really saw that.
It's on New York at the moment?
Yeah, after it was sold out for, I don't know how long, where you are.
Oh, wow. I don't know how I missed that. I don't think I even saw it advertised, but that's probably because, you know what life is like. It just gets so, so busy. Yeah. So I'm a bit gutted, but
yeah, that's the Alameda Theater. By the time this releases, it'll be long gone from New York, sadly. But who knows? Maybe I'll have another life.
Oh, we'll keep an eye out and see what she's in next.
Anyway, what about you? You've seen a lot.
I have. Well, I have. Since the last episode, I've seen 3 Holocaust productions. I saw a friend in a production that I'm not going to talk about because I'm still processing it. Not in a good way. And let's leave it at that. TBC. But two productions that I saw most recently were brilliant. So, so good. So I saw White Rose the Musical. Mm-hmm. At the Marylebone Theatre in London, who, by the way, I think should probably start giving me commission, because it feels like every time I'm on an episode of this, I'm talking about something the Marylebone has done.
Marylebone, we're awaiting your call.
Yep. Hashtag sponsor. Mm-hmm. So yeah, White Rose the Musical. So it's the story of Sophie and Hans Scholl in Munich and the White Rose resistance movement and how they published and printed and circulated anti-Nazi leaflets, and you know, the story does not have a happy ending. They were caught and they were executed, but the musical is really engaging and really draws out the characters, and you see how especially the young men like Hans and his friends were actually serving soldiers, and their experiences on the front line and of seeing what was happening and what was being done informed them. So yeah, I really recommend it. It's on until the 13th of April.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're in London and you're about, get a ticket, go and see it. You'll thank me later. And I also saw Farewell Mr. Halfman at the Park Theatre here in London. That's another one that I recommend, and it combines really dark comedy with sort of like that notion of what we've spoken about before around impossible choices and what it means to save a life, what it means to be involved, what are the implications around the potential for collaboration, how can you make sure that, how are you ever sure that you're really safe, what are the stories that we tell ourselves when we're in these situations. Very strange, just in terms of the plot. I don't want to say too much without giving it away. I mean, it won the Molière Award. I think like 4 Molière Awards in France. It was originally written in French, translated to English. Go see it, look it up. They've done a film of it as well, but I think that's in French. So yeah, recommend that one. Actually gave it 4.5 stars out of 5.
Okay.
So would definitely recommend that.
Not to put you on the spot, but who wrote the White Rose, the musical?
So the book and lyrics are by Brian Belding, and the music is by Natalie Bryce.
Okay, and this was their premiere?
I think it premiered off-Broadway in 2024. I think this was the UK premiere for White Rose, yep.
Gotcha. Okay, yes. I heard there was a White Rose, the musical happening last year, but I never managed to go see it, so I wasn't sure if it was the same one. So yeah, cool.
The thing is, you know, obviously a different cast over here, so there was going to be, but yeah, it was great. It was good. The only constructive feedback I had, because I went to see it on one of like during the previews, mm-hmm. and you could tell that the cast was still quite nervous. And they weren't really letting themselves go, and really, you know, they didn't quite own the stage yet.
Okay.
So that was the only reason why it sort of wasn't up a notch in my estimation.
Gotcha.
And
I'd be curious to see what it's like at the end of their run.
I was thinking that. I was like, shall I go back? But,
yeah, go back.
And, because, you know, what is time? What is money? And Farewell, Mr. Hoffman was originally written in French by Jean-Philippe Daguerre and was adapted by Jeremy Sams.
Cool.
So, yes, definitely recommend it. And I feel like we will be discussing those later mm-hmm. down the line because they're really, really good.
Sounds good.
In my humble opinion. Nice. Also, plot twist, we have our first corrections corner.
Da 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 da.
Da da da.
Sorry, I was like, yay. Welcome, corrections corner. Welcome
well,
to the pod.
Yeah, welcome to the pod. Come in, sit down. It's been a while. So, as we're always saying in our episodes, you know, if you want to, we want you to contact us if you have an idea or a correction. So, one is a correction that I realised, and the other is a semi-correction that a friend contacted me with. So, the one that I realised was that in our last episode, where we talked about all our children, it was said that Janusz Korczak wasn't Jewish. And he actually was. So Korczak was a well-known paediatrician and writer in Poland during the Second World War, the Holocaust. He was the director of an orphanage in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he ultimately chose to go with his children, quote-unquote, to Treblinka and die with them rather than utilise his fame and contacts to get out, which he would have been able to do. So because of that, a lot of people think he wasn't Jewish. But I suspected, so I was like, so I went away, looked it up. Yes, he was born into a highly assimilated Polish Jewish family. So just wanted to make that super clear. And then my friend, John Naples Campbell, hi John, he reached out with a really interesting question. So John is a Holocaust educator and theatre maker, as well as having plenty of great suggestions for plays we could cover. He also sent me this, and I'll read it for you. Interested to know why you didn't classify Fear and Misery of the Third Reich by Brecht as one of the first Holocaust plays, especially The Jewish Wife.
Mm.
My flabbers were ghasted, because do you remember in episode one, and you asked me if The Diary of Anne Frank was the first Holocaust play?
Yeah.
And I was chatting away and talking about, you know, plays by Ben Hecht and Lillian Hellman. And then John sending me that actually made me realise I didn't make it clear at all that I was talking about English language Holocaust plays. Mm. So John, a really big thank you for pointing that
thank
out.
Thank you.
Kind of, yeah. We would love to invite you to come and talk to us on the show about Fear and Misery of the Third Reich. Please do. And even before John's message, another friend, I have friends, who knew, who's a specialist in theatre that happened during the Holocaust, said she'd like to come and talk to us about her work and also some amazing discoveries she made.
Mm-hmm.
So, everyone should stay tuned. And Alex, you should
fantastic.
Please say something, because this is turning into a one woman play. You know, all waffle, no syrup. Please say something.
I'm the corrections corner wasn't my idea. It was yours. I was simply giving you the floor. This makes no sense.
I know.
Why you gotta put me on the spot?
Because you're an actor and you can improvise.
Okay, but as your producer colleague, you know, how about we just move on to the disclaimers?
Before we start, it's time for the disclaimers.
Disclaimer number one. Sam and I both work for outside organizations, but this podcast is entirely on us. This is our indie project, and we are not representing the organizations that we work for in this capacity. So if you don't like something you hear, blame us, not them.
Disclaimer number two. The Holocaust is an incredibly dark subject. So because we work with it every day, we use humour as a coping mechanism. We want to be really clear that we're not mocking the Holocaust, we are not mocking victims or survivors, we in no way intend to be disrespectful. Having said that, we do use dark humour at times, so please bear this in mind while listening.
And number three is our rule of engagement. If you have questions, a suggestion for an episode, like John, thank you, John, again, a correction or a comment, then let us know. You can find the contact details in the show notes. And yeah, that's it on that disclaimer corner. So shall we?
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. That's become like our little rolling thing, hasn't it? Because you go, oh, shall we? And I always say, let's do it. Let's do it.
Today, we're looking at Angus Jackson's stage adaptation of John Boyne's novel, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
Also known as The Holocaust Educator's Curse. For reasons that you and I both know well, Alex.
Yeah, well, please explain to our listeners, why is it called that?
What, The Holocaust Educator's Curse?
Yeah.
How long have you got?
Can you give us a 2-minute version?
What, as to why it's the Holocaust Educator's Curse? Or mm-hmm. I could, but then that would literally be the episode. It's just me going 2 minutes, Blair, thank you, thanks for coming, great chat, see you
where
next week.
Where did this, I mean, what's the origins of this? Like, how did you first hear about it? I'll share how I first heard about it.
Oh, that's a really good, that's a really good question. I don't actually know how I first heard about it. I know, because obviously, if you're in the field and you know, but the novel was written in 2005, 2006. So long before the PhD, anything, you know, sort of my career choices had come into being, I had read the book. I don't know how I first encountered it, but I know that I read it and thought, this is actually a really, really good piece of writing. It's a very clever piece of writing.
Yeah.
Especially in the way, and we'll talk about this in a bit, but the way that, for example, the Führer becomes the Fury, Auschwitz becomes Outwith, and sort of that childish comprehension but childish misunderstanding at the same time, and not kind of getting it right but falling a bit wide of the mark. So I thought it was very, very well done from that perspective, and the you know, it is a very engaging story. But then, knowing what I know now, and having been to Auschwitz and obviously working as a Holocaust educator and working with a lot of Holocaust educators, including your lovely self, and having those conversations and going, this is really, really problematic, because a whole generation of school children are growing up thinking that this is somehow based on a true story. Not helped, I would argue, by the fact that, especially in recent years, there's been such a huge number of books with the blank of Auschwitz. The librarian of Auschwitz, the twins of Auschwitz, the tattooist of Auschwitz, the photographer of Auschwitz. Just giving examples of, you know, ones that pop into my brain. And normally they're, in the majority of cases, they are novels and based on a true story.
Sure.
And then that's where the problems begin. But yeah, how, I feel like there might be a story behind when you first encountered BSP, as it's, you know, the short version.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think it really, I mean, I must have been aware of it before I came into Holocaust education, because the movie came out when? Like, so it was the book, book in 2006. I think the movie came out in 2008.
Really?
Like, pretty soon after.
This is where I jump straight over to Google and go, Rabbi Google, talk to us. Film, IMDb, 2008. Great shout. Well done. Yes.
Yeah.
You win a cookie.
So that's an amazing turnaround. And then when did the play come about?
The play was 2015.
2015. Interesting. Because you usually see, I don't know, I guess it's becoming more common where, you know, films are now being adapted to the stage and musicals. Shout out Mean Girls. And then back into films. But let's back up first, because I don't think we've really given the due summary of the story of The Boy in the Striped Pajamas. The book and the play follows Bruno, a young German boy whose family moves to a house near a concentration camp after his father, a Nazi commandant, is promoted. Bruno befriends Shmuel. I'm going to do that again. Bruno befriends Shmuel, a Jewish boy imprisoned in the camp, leading to a forbidden friendship that ends tragically. Spoiler alert. Well, this episode will be riddled with spoiler alerts.
Yeah.
So
the first one being, it's not a true story.
Yep, first and foremost. Yeah, and I think that's I mean, let's see, did I first hear, you know, a Holocaust educator that I was working with talking about, you know, teachers using Boy in the Striped Pajamas, or did I first hear a teacher say that they use it in their classrooms? I'm not sure. But the thesis was the same. It's just that it's not great teaching material because it is purely fictional. But there are schools that include it in their curriculum. I've heard it less, it's been used less, I feel, or it's come up in conversation less recently. Yeah. I mean, Diary of Anne Frank, the play, and Number of the Stars have been at the top of the list. So,
I feel like, but, I mean, especially, I mean,
yeah,
especially from a UK perspective, it seems like from sort of like the mid noughties for a few years, because, you know, the book comes out and suddenly everyone goes, oh my goodness, there's this book and it tells the story and it's got friendship and it's got family dynamics and it's got all of the things that, you know, children and young people can empathize with, they can engage with, and it's a non-graphic way of introducing children to the Holocaust. And sure. So from my perspective, essentially what happened was you had a large number of very well-meaning English teachers who went, oh great, I can teach my students about the Holocaust, and we're reading this book in class, but not ensuring that there was appropriate contextual teaching happening at the same time. Yeah. So it feels like the English departments and the history departments weren't quite chatting in the staff room.
Yeah.
And saying, hey, by the way, I'm teaching this. And obviously, like you say, with, you know, curriculums and the pressures on teachers, which are ridiculous. And there's, in the UK or in England, there's no, the Holocaust is on the curriculum, but there is nothing currently that specifies how many hours, how many lessons, how long it should go on for, that Holocaust education happens for.
Yeah.
So when you've got a long list of things that need / have to be taught, there's not always going to be that space for more involved, holistic teaching about the Holocaust. On the flip side of that, it means that there are quite a few, well, I say kids, you know, it's been a while, but quite a number of British school children who think that The Boy in the Striped Pajamas is a true story. And there have been so many countless times I've gone into schools and been in a classroom and been measuring, that's the wrong way to put it, take that out, but talking to the kids about what they already know about the Holocaust. And I will say, who here has read The Boy in the Striped Pajamas? They'll put their hands up. Okay, hands down. Who's seen the film? They all put their hands up. Okay, hands down. Who knows it's not true? And the gasps and the what? And then explaining to them. And it's a really valuable teaching moment to kind of say to them, you have to be careful about anything that says it's based on a true story or mm-hmm. those kind of things, you know, novels, plays, anything mm-hmm. that's fictionalized. But at the same time, yeah.
Yeah, clarifying that the circumstances were definitely real, but this story...
Yeah.
Not, yeah.
Yeah.
Even, so that's fascinating to know that, to hear that they thought it was a true story when both mm. the book and the play open and introduce the story as a fable. Yep. Which I took issue with.
Oh, okay, yes. Multiple coins have just dropped. Go on.
Well, I think just because, I mean, I could understand, okay, Boyne and Jackson, you know, keeping that in of just trying to communicate to readers and viewers and doing their due diligence as storytellers that this is a fictional story. I could see, you know, where they were coming from mm. in using that term, but for me the word fable just has so many mythical connotations, and I feel like that's a responsibility we have as educators and theater makers to try to, you know, remove the mythical elements of the Holocaust mm. and the storytelling of the Holocaust to, you know, bring home the message, this is very real.
So is it,
remember these stories that we've lost also mm. and I was just like, and how do we define a fable? So I'm like, well, I know my idea of a fable of, you know, just being like, you know, a short children's story, often in fantasy. I look it up, it's from Oxford, and it says a short story typically with animals as characters conveying a moral.
Oh, see, I honestly thought...
I'm like, oh, God, this is even more problematic. Yeah.
But I actually, when you said, oh, it's a fable, I actually thought you were going to go a different way with that and say that by calling it a fable, it's calling the actual historical facts of the Holocaust into question.
Oh.
That's where I thought you were going with that. And then I was like, ooh, plot twist. Because you say fable, I think Aesop's fables.
Sure.
Which, you know, these, the moral, like you say, they've got the animals...
Mm-hmm.
but have this moral of, you know, different things you should do or not do.
Yeah.
That's really, yeah, I'm like, oh, can you hear the wheels turning? That's genuinely really interesting. Because I yeah. liked the fact, I did pick up as well when I was rereading the play on that emphasis again on the fable at the beginning, the fact that it's typed out in letters. You know, it says in the stage directions, it's typed up on the projected onto right. the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, I feel like multiple lessons have been learned at this point. That there's been a big outcry
mm-hmm.
Against just setting the book for students to read and letting mm-hmm. them think that it's real.
And I thought it was fascinating, you know, reading in the stage directions of just how much it, the whole play is also presented as a storybook. I mean, you see the projections of each chapter title typed up on the back of the stage. So it wasn't what, so I had read the book and then, you know, had ideas of just, okay, how can the play take it a little further? Mm. What kind of conversations and, you know, liberties does the playwright take? And it stayed very close to the source, Boyne's source text. So I was a little disappointed.
How come?
No, just like I was kind of hoping, well, maybe there would be more we'd capture more conversations between the adults. We do, but not really. I wondered how, because where the book really delves deep into, so it's all third person, but definitely with, you know, insight into the inner workings of Bruno's mind and his thought process. So I wondered how that would be conveyed on stage. Are we going to get some inner monologues from Bruno, which would be a huge task for the child actor. But where I feel like the novel is almost a more responsible teaching tool than the play. Ooh. With the way that it,
I'm fascinated. This is why I always love talking to you about these things, because you have so many different viewpoints and just present so many great ideas. So please keep talking.
Yeah, it just feels like a more responsible teaching tool because it does give the students a little bit more insight into where Bruno is coming from. So, and he's also, especially for students who are meeting, you know, the topic of the Holocaust for the first time and are just totally overwhelmed by, you know, the scope of it and how could this happen. Having a character be the narrator that they follow, who's also coming from a place of naivete, who's been dropped into this horror landscape, I think is, and just where the book has, you know, his life experience and his thought process and the way that he's processing the things that are happening around him, it has that all lined out, where the play might on, you know, in a visual level, but I haven't seen production. Have you?
I did. I actually saw it when it had the UK tour in 2015.
Awesome.
And I think it's really interesting what you were saying about the imagination and sort of the children's side of things, because there was a lot of, not like imaginary play, but the a lot of physical theatre, so sort of him getting out of the house and sort of climbing and running and climbing trees and vaulting over, you know, sort of logs and rocks and things was really, really well done. And sort of the way that he kind of quote unquote escaped from the house and was sneaking out was really, really well done. It's really interesting what you say about the visual side of things, because again, one of the things that I keep coming back to when I talk about The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas or look at it is how easy it is for every point for it, there's a point against it. So for example, you know, like you said, on a visual level, and also you're getting potentially students up on their feet and moving, actually acting things out. But then the thing against that is, what's the maturity of your students? At what point do they carry that acting out and, you know, moving around and experiencing these things out into the playground and kids being kids? On the flip side of that, one of the things that I liked about the play was when Bruno and Shmuel first meet at the fence, and they're having a conversation about the different symbols that they wear. And Shmuel is talking about the star that he wears. Bruno is talking about the cross with the extra bits that his dad wears. You have those in the book as, you know, little symbols. And in the play, they're projected onto the psych at the back of the stage. So I think still enabling those conversations and what those symbols mean.
And I wish I could see production, because I feel having, you know, the physical theater elements will help audience feel that kind of visceral, you know, journey that that Bruno is going on, coming from a place of, you know, a place of safety in Berlin where everything's familiar, and you know, he has his comforts, to being dropped into a very new and gray and frightening place.
See, the issue that I have with the headline issue that I have with The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas overall is you cry because the wrong boy dies.
Whoa, okay.
People get upset because Bruno dies at the end. Everyone's expecting Shmuel to die. Everyone, we know immediately who Shmuel is. We know what his fate is.
Yeah.
But when Bruno goes through the fence and he goes into the camp and then is lost, no one's expected to be like, oh, that's so tragic. Are they crying for both? Are people crying for both boys?
I mean, that's somewhat provocative. Sure. I mean, that's my main issue with it, too, is that we're so focused on Bruno's story and his side of the story. And he's just, and because of that, he's just, you know, a more of a multidimensional character than Shmuel is. I am certainly projecting, you know, more ideas of what his story is just as an actor. So I'm definitely, you know, sympathizing with him more just because I... you know, when I'm thinking about the train platform that Bruno saw, I know exactly what's happening on the other side of that platform that he doesn't quite understand. When Shmuel is talking about when they had to leave their home and they were moved into a room with 11 other people and several other families, I know exactly what that's referencing. So I feel like that could be, you know, if it's, I could see teachers wanting to teach the play because they're pressed for time, but if there's time to also read the book along with another book, but also taking breaks between each chapter, just like, what do you think this is that here, let's give you some background on what exactly Bruno's describing. This is what it was in history. Here's some, you know, images from that time. But yeah, that's the main issue. I feel like a lot of Holocaust educators have with it, that I have with, that we're not seeing enough from Shmuel's perspective. And yeah, so most of the sympathy goes towards Bruno, and we see the people that mourned them.
Here's a thought. Can you imagine if they did a version of The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, but it was from Shmuel's perspective?
Well, that's what I was imagining, when, because then I also heard that they're doing a sequel.
Oh, wait,
or
what?
A second part or something. That's what I heard. And I was to the book.
Yeah, it's already been published. Oh, I can't remember the name of it, but it's... I think I know what your reaction's going to be. It's from Gretel's perspective, as I think she's either an adult...
Why? Wait. Sorry.
I think... No, you are probably not alone.
I'm sorry,
but that announcement. I think if memory serves me correctly, she's definitely an adult, but I don't know if she's actually an old lady. But it's her recalling what happened. I'm gonna consult Google.
Oh God.
And we'll have a look. And let's have a look. I'm sure. I feel like it was, yeah, all the broken places.
Okay. I was kind of hoping that, I mean,
it was published in 2022.
Okay. This is a horrible comparison, but I thought that, you know, maybe they would have gone the Stephanie Meyer route and, like, you know, so you read a book from somebody else's point of view, so the other side of the fence. So.
Oh, I have to read this to you. You're gonna love this. Here we go. So I've gone online, I have Googled, and this is one of the results that comes back. 91-year-old Gretel Fernsby has lived in the same mansion block in London for decades. She leads a comfortable, quiet life despite her dark and disturbing past. She doesn't talk about her escape from Germany over 70 years before. That is very loaded. She doesn't talk about the post-war years in France with her mother. Most of all, she doesn't talk about her father, the commandant of one of the most notorious Nazi concentration camps. Then, a young family moves into the apartment below her. In spite of herself, Gretel can't help but begin a friendship with the little boy, Henry, though his presence brings back memories she would rather forget. One night, she witnesses a violent argument between Henry's mother and his domineering father, one that threatens Gretel's hard-won, self-contained existence. Gretel is faced with a chance to expiate her guilt, grief, and remorse, and act to save a young boy for the second time in her life. But to do so, she will be forced to reveal her true identity to the world. Will she make a different choice this time, whatever the cost to herself? All the Broken Places is a devastating, beautiful story about a woman who must confront the sins of her past and a present in which it is never too late for bravery.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it just has, yeah, just the fact we're both sitting here going, I mean, if you're mad about that, I don't read The Boy at the Top of the Mountain, which is also by John Boyne. That's also by John Boyne, and came out a couple of years after The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. And again, it's interesting because this time it's from the perspective of another young boy, but how he kind of drifts into Nazism. And, you know, then it turns out that, you know, I think something happens to his parents, and then it turns out that his aunt just happens to be Hitler's housekeeper. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to live there. There's a plot to kill Hitler with a poison Stollen. I'm not even making this up. It's an experience.
Can you describe my face right now?
Despair, weariness, exasperation. And if you keep chewing your lip like that, you're going to need some serious lip balm. I'm just saying.
I'm so disappointed.
There's a trope that it definitely fits into a lot of the trope, but circling back around, I wanted to come back to what you were saying about how Bruno is taken from, you know, the safety of Berlin, ironically, and dropped into this place where he doesn't know anyone, he has all of these questions and this kind of thing. And for me, again, that's one of the reasons why I think The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas is a really useful teaching tool, is because mm-hmm. it encourages critical thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
Because students...
He's asking all the questions that the students would ask.
Exactly, that the students would ask. And we can say to them, well, of course you're asking these questions because you have also been dropped into the situation. Whereas Bruno would have been a member of the Hitler Youth. He would have been indoctrinated, or would be in the process of being indoctrinated. We see that with Gretel.
We see in Gretel in the play, in the book, you don't really see her starting to put on the Hitler Youth.
Or the League of German Girls, yeah. So right, it's there. So you kind of see that hinted at with Gretel. But they got to them younger. So being able to say to them, well, actually, that's not historically accurate. And explaining to them about the Hitler Youth and explaining how these children were indoctrinated and taught to do things like inform on their parents, or, you know, listen out and become tiny spies, and the propaganda, mm-hmm. and the fact that Hitler was not some kind of demon headmaster, and that he fed on the existing anti-Semitism, and, you know, you look at Goebbels as propaganda minister and dripping this poison into people's ears for years and years,
mm-hmm.
and kind of going at, so on the one hand, yes, you're asking all the right questions because you're being dropped into it as well. On the other, this is why it's problematic. This is why the critical thinking is important.
Mm-hmm.
And even things like the layout of the camp and where the commandant's villa was. And have you seen the film?
The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas? No.
Yeah. So I'd be very unsurprised to know that when I watched the film, I was a nightmare, because thankfully I wasn't in the cinema, but I just kept, well, that's factually incorrect for one. Nope, that's not how it looks.
You can't watch this with a Holocaust educator. Yeah. Like, nope. Just everything's ruined.
Exactly.
Ruined for you. Just like, also that's not accurate. That's not accurate. If he was that little, he would not have been,
exactly. And, you know, really,
Shmuel would not have
the
lived
number,
to the nine,
and it's awful, the number of students that I have bummed out by pointing out to them that Shmuel wouldn't have survived the selection.
Mm-mm.
You know, so when he's talking about, oh, there's, I think he says either dozens or hundreds of boys on this side of the fence that are my, you know, my size. Mm-hmm. No, my love, there aren't. No. There weren't. You wouldn't have. Yeah. Yes, there were children in Auschwitz. We need to be really, really clear about that. And yes, there were children in Auschwitz, and there were babies born in Auschwitz, and there was a children's block in Auschwitz. But the way that the children's block was run, the way that children were kept, the way that some children were hidden, would not have allowed Shmuel to wander free. And that, you know, going and sitting at the fences, which were electrified, and had a literally a no man's zone, and all of these, all of the historical facts. So the one thing that I, so like we've said, the book, the play, they introduce children, let's face it, children to the horrors of the Holocaust without being too graphic, without really going into it. On the flip side, to give those students the critical thinking and to get them, you have to teach them about the horrors. You've got to sanitize it if you don't want to traumatize them. We'll be very, very careful about what you choose to work with so that you don't traumatize them, which then begs the question, okay, why work with the book or the play at all?
I think that's a great question. Why work with it at all? You know, I think I'll echo what you had said, that it's a safer entry point, which it is, you know, it presents the Holocaust from a safe distance for students. So it's something not to teach for historical accuracy, but to what you said, you know, get them into a place of critical thinking, curiosity,
asking the questions,
and also, you know, with the responses that Bruno gets, does that make sense? You know, Bruno asks, like, who are they? Gretel says, oh, they're Jews. And it's like, are we Jews? No, we're not. Well, then what are we? And she can't answer it. So
yeah, she's like, we're the opposite.
But it's a good, I think it's a, that's a good introduction, I think, for students about just the kind of thinking and non-logic that this was whole atrocity was born into. And also, as you're delving into your Holocaust education, coming from the perspective of the, I think the, you know, he says this is a fable, so fable comes with a moral. What's the moral? What's the lesson? And you are seeing these two boys constantly, you know, they're presented as almost a reflection of one another. So I feel like, okay, well, I guess this is a good story to introduce to students to remind us we are the same. We're very different, but ultimately the same.
I think as well, what you were saying, I mean, what works with the play is that in my humble opinion, I think more than the novel, it's more practical, it gets students up on their feet. They're not, and I'm probably doing a massive disservice to a lot of teachers here, but they're not sitting in a classroom reading aloud.
Gotcha.
With the play text, the expectation is, yes, you're reading aloud, but you're also performing while you're doing it.
Yeah.
So it's got that going for it. On the flip side of that, it is a very, very fine line to, how do you think so-and-so felt when this happened? Imagine that you, you know, and there's such a fine line with doing that and inadvertently straying into, let's imagine that, let's pretend that, which you have to be on your guard against.
The moral is, like, we're all human. I think that's ultimately what he wanted readers to walk away with. So
the other thing I could talk about, because I've got an article here from University College London, Centre for Holocaust Education, and they did a piece of research about how a lot of young people had mistaken or misleading conclusions about the Holocaust because of the boy in the striped pyjamas. And one of the really interesting things, which you touched upon earlier, was this concept of Bruno as a victim. And they actually have a quote, and I'll put the link to the article in the show notes. There's a quote from students who took part in this research. I think it's really interesting. First quote is from a student aged about 14, and they say, quote, "Well, we always think of the Nazis as the bad guys, and this shows that the Holocaust didn't just affect the Jews." That's the first quote. Mm-hmm. And then the second quote is, "I feel sorry for practically everybody who was under Hitler's control. And it doesn't matter who was the bigger victim, they were all still victims of Hitler's control in some shape or form." And that was from a student who was about 16 years old, year 11.
Okay. How do you feel about that?
Again, I can see the fors and against, you know, that the Holocaust mm-hmm. didn't just affect the Jews.
Yeah.
Objectively, that's not wrong.
That's not wrong.
But in the same time, perceiving the son of a commandant, or even the commandant himself when he loses Bruno, as a victim,
mm-hmm.
big problematic question mark over that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all still victims of Hitler's control in some shape or form. And again, it kind of ascribes Hitler this kind of demon headmaster quality.
Mm-hmm.
And again, comes back to, I don't know if you've heard this as an educator, but a lot of people turning around and saying, oh, well, the soldiers had to do what they were told or they would have been shot, which was never used in any trial as a defense of Nazi trials. I had to do what I was told or I would have been shot.
Mm-hmm.
Never used as a defense. Not correct. So yeah. This whole idea of Nazis as being somehow having no agency or not wanting to do. And I know they run the whole gamut. They run the whole spectrum of anti-Semitism and, you know, diehard Nazis versus the conscripts versus the hidden resistors, all that kind of thing. But that idea of everyone being under Hitler's control and nobody having any agency, nobody making choices, it all just suddenly randomly happened because Hitler was in power, and laying all the blame on Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I find obviously that's very troubling. Problematic.
Yeah.
But I think, again, opening up those questions for discussion, and I think the more these questions are very difficult, and I think that's good, because I think there is so much scope for students to have these discussions and to be having these conversations and to be having these debates and going, oh yeah, but wait, what about this? Well, in this context, what about this? And kind of showing them that the world, is not just black and white.
Yeah.
And avoiding absolutes whilst at the same time understanding that, you know, if you, as we are seeing a lot of the memes going around on social media at the moment, if you look around, if you're out in public and you look around and you're standing with Nazis, you're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
I think it kind of feeds into that and just questions of responsibility and accountability and being critical. What is somebody's agenda? Am I doing the mm-hmm. right thing? Are they doing the right thing? What is the right thing?
Yeah. I mean, I will say, I mean, I feel like Boyne really, and Jackson in the play, does, you know, show the complacency of the...
Oh, yeah.
You know, the family... and the maid, but you know, do they raise it enough to the forefront to be, you know, a point of you know, to bring attention to it, and how do we, you know, get out of that rut of complacency?
But I think flipping the script entirely, I wonder what it would be like to take the play and the book not away from younger students, but that's what I'm going to say. Take it away from younger students and take it to older
students.
Rip it out of their hands and say, you can't read this. But work with older students, and by that I mean sort of, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-olds, college age, older, and get them looking, you know, these ideas of complacency as represented in The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, mm-hmm. The Zone of Interest. And mm-hmm. looking at sources such as the Auschwitz Museum's publication, The Private Lives of the Auschwitz SS,
mm-hmm.
which has accounts of the servants who worked for the SS, who ran Auschwitz, and were able to talk about these men coming home and, you know, the trope of they loved classical music and liked to have their boots clean and kiss their wives goodnight and then engaged in mass murder the next day. But mm-hmm. hearing these first-hand accounts and going, this is actually what it was like. And I wonder what it would be like to bring those kind of sources in
yeah.
with students and go, okay, so here's the disconnect. Mm-hmm. Here's something for you to think about.
I think that would be a very intriguing project, honestly.
Maybe someone's already done it and they'll email us and go, I've already been doing this and this is what I think.
Yeah.
Alex, I would like to ask a controversial question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for this? Massive segue. Did you know there was a boy in the striped pajamas, the ballet?
What?
Your face.
Oh. Good job, John Boyne.
I feel we need to do a video. We need to release some video content for this podcast because your face actually priceless.
That's okay. Did you see it?
I did.
How was it?
I was a special guest.
Good for you.
I know, it was the first ballet I ever saw. It was a trip. It was, I did write a review of it, which has been lost to the mists of time, but okay. I remember I described it as neither a disaster piece nor a masterpiece.
Oh my God. Wow. All right.
Yeah, I mean the ballet dance, the dancing was amazing. You know, mm-hmm. it's ballet, they're athletes. It's mm-hmm. incredible. So they had a character that was called the Fury. Mm-hmm. Alex, it was very industrial. There was lots of black leather. There was a gas mask. And our first encounter with the Fury is them crawling out from under the Commandant's desk and then doing a sequence with uniformed Nazis and them literally throwing shapes as moving their bodies into the shapes of swastikas. And it was really, really well done and really, yeah. really problematic because it implied they had no agency
yeah.
and that they were overtaken by the Fury, which we all know is Hitler,
yeah.
and weren't able to help themselves and didn't have the agency.
Okay.
It was quite an experience. I mean, it wouldn't have.
Also, it kind of leans into him as a symbol and like.
Yeah. But that's the thing is yeah. that the Fury was very androgynous. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember if it was a male or female dancer. I believe it was male. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't clear, and like I said, they're wearing what I would describe as a Gestapo coat, which, you know, like the leather overcoat.
Sure. Like a duster.
It was a trip. It was quite something. And we got free wine at the interval, so I was down for that.
Just yeah. knocking them back.
Just like.
The ballet.
So yeah, so there's been The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, the book, the film, the play, and the ballet. All we need is The Boy in the Striped Pajamas on ice and we're good to go.
Please God.
I kind of want to Google that right now.
No, God. No, I mean.
I'm not going to do that. Because
it's just so, I mean, okay. It's just fascinating to me. I don't know. I kind of want to take a poll. Like, what's on people's minds when they, you know, when we ask them, okay, name a Holocaust novel or name a Holocaust, a book from the Holocaust, about the Holocaust. I have a feeling The Boy in the Striped Pajamas is up there. I mean, USA Today at the front in this cover, I'm looking at my copy that I found on a stoop, by the way, in Park Slope. And I was like, I guess I have to pick this up. I have to read this at some point. Powerful and unsettling, as memorable an introduction to the subject as the Diary of Anne Frank.
Oh, I knew that was good. No.
Which I'm just like, I am struggling having these, both of these books on the same.
Okay. What did category, they say? As memorable and what?
As memorable an introduction to the subject as the Diary of Anne Frank. But an introduction through the, by way of the world of the perpetrators.
It's equating, is it memorable? Yes, because it's one of the first, like you say, if we did a poll, it would be up there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that is so obviously so problematic because it's equate, you know, yes, Bruno is a victim. Shmuel is a victim, but they're fictional victims.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is the all lives matter of Holocaust literature. Sorry.
I'm laughing just because that delivery was perfect, but yeah, it's, yeah, you're so right. But it's, the issue that I have is that it would be very easy to take a hard line either for or against The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. It's either, like I said at the top very flippantly, the Holocaust educator's curse,
mm-hmm.
and should not be taught under any circumstances. But then by doing that, we're not helping young people, I think. I'm not saying it should definitely be taught, but if we say, no, we're not going to teach it, we're kind of closing one door and not enabling that as critical thinking. If we're saying, oh, right, they shouldn't read these books because they're not factually accurate, the focus should entirely be, I mean, of course, survivor testimonies should be front and center.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
On the flip side of that, it's important to look at how history is, even in well-meaning ways, is distorted. Mm-hmm. And fictionalized, and what the problems are with that, just giving them that awareness, I think, is important. Just kind of going, sure. Yeah, people will try and tell you this thing, just take it with a grain of salt, just have a think about it.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, that's the thing with it. And I know that I have so many educator friends who will be on my tail after listening to this episode saying, how could you, and you know, no, don't talk about, you know, positives of teaching it or working with it. For me,
yeah, I mean, I, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, I was just gonna say, for me, I fortunately or unfortunately am very much on the fence with this. I can't say for definite one way or the other.
Yeah, same. I mean, I was, you know, you said, you decided as executive producer, we're going to cover Boy in the Striped Pajamas for episode 4. And I was like, why? Because, like, just because of everything that I had heard, you know, about it, having not read it myself, I just know it's just like, oh, Boy in the Striped Pajamas, bad. No, don't touch it. So I was approaching this thinking by the end of the episode, I was going to be like, no. Don't teach it. Don't touch it. And, but, you know, then I read the book and I read the play and I just walked away being like, I mean, if you want to, go ahead. But just not by itself, please. Make sure it's in conversation with, you know, another, with the Diary of Anne Frank and another primary source text and historical context. And survivor testimony.
Definitely. And also working with, and, you know, working with reputable sources. So the Auschwitz Museum, where they mm-hmm. have the online sessions and lessons about children in Auschwitz, and United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, not Wikipedia. You and I have had this conversation, and Wikipedia is great as a springboard. I find the sources for an article, when you get to the bottom and you see those, are really, really helpful.
Sure.
Wikipedia should not be your primary source and what you're teaching from.
Wikipedia is your search. To quote Henry Cavill.
And even using it, well, I don't like to say using it, working with it as an exercise to send students off, if you know full well what the historical issues are, and asking them, you know, giving them passages or scenes from the play and saying, hey, go away, do some research onto on this and look up, you know, come back to me and tell me what the issues are. How is this historically inaccurate? How is this not correct? And go from there would be my suggestion. We covered a lot and hopefully puts a little bit of a new spin on what feels like a very old argument around it, but saying that we can't fall one side or other of the fence. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although I'm very aware that me saying, oh, we can't come down one side or other of the fence is a very inappropriate metaphor to use at this point.
Oh my God. There's that dark Holocaust educator humor. Yeah.
So yeah, probably shouldn't use either side of the fence in that context, but there we go.
I will say I am kind of, I mean, I know you didn't really like the film, but now that I've, I don't think I'll touch the ballet, but I don't know when I'd have the opportunity even.
I mean, you're in New York. There's gotta be someone who'd be willing to do it as like an improv piece on a Saturday night. Go on.
Oh God. I am curious about the film now, because just, you know, reading the book, I'm like, oh, how might this be portrayed in, you know, in the film? I mean, it's if they're gearing it also towards more, you know, mature audiences, my brain definitely went to darker places of just like, what exactly is the relationship between the mom and the lieutenant? Is the lieutenant like playing both the very, very, very young daughter and the mom? Like, that's disturbing.
There's definitely that. Yeah. The thing that I use the term loosely, the thing that I liked more about the film, possibly because of the dramatic effect, is in the play and the book, Bruno goes missing, and it isn't until quite a while afterwards that they find his clothes at the fence, and they try and work out, or they find the clothes at the fence, and then they can't figure out for the life of them where Bruno has gone, and then it takes the commandant a few weeks, and then he suddenly realizes what's happened. Mm-hmm. And that's in the book and the play. In the film, they know that he's headed for the camp. So they are literally running through the rain to try and stop him. Gretel, mother, father, they're running. And there is that moment in the film where you think they're going to get there in time. Mm. Which again opens up some interesting questions, because for argument's sake, it's a bit like Juliet in the tomb, right? If someone had got there in time, how would the story be different? If they got to the gas chamber in time, they would only have pulled Bruno out.
Right.
They wouldn't have saved Shmuel.
No, yeah.
So, that's a question. So they're running to the fence. They get there, they find the clothes, and they all realise immediately what's happened. And everyone just falls apart. Because they know there's no point. And I can't remember if in the film they then have that moment, which they have in the book and the end of the play, where they say, and that's the end of the story about Bruno and his family. Of course, all this happened a long time ago, and nothing like that could ever happen again. Not in this day and age.
Yeah.
Because as we all know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
Yeah. Not in this day and age. I read that and I'm like, it is a flippant way of like ending it.
But you see, when I first read the book, that's one of the things, and also with the play as well, the fact that they keep that in there. And when I read the book, it felt like such a slap across the face, because it felt like someone was going, but yeah, that didn't, you know, such a thing couldn't happen. Not today, not in this day and age. It's almost like throwing down the gauntlet in an argument. You know, when you're furious with someone, or maybe it's just me, you're furious with someone to the point that you are so sarcastic. And you go, of course that couldn't happen. Not in this day and age. No, of course it couldn't. I'm interested to know if any of our listeners are educators who have worked with the Boy in the Striped Pyjamas in any capacity, whether they've done it through the critical thinking lens or whether they've done it through the this is a really good piece of writing and then realize later down the line, oh no, what have I done? And so if you're an educator and you have worked with the Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, please let us know. Let us know your experience of working with it, how it went, how your students engaged with it. Do you have a, you know, are you more hardcore than Alex and I, and you will, you know, very definitively state yes, you should work with it, or no, you shouldn't, and why? Because I'm really interested to hear what other people think.
Yeah, same.
Amazing.
All right. Well, take care. Drink water.
Be
Tell your
kind
friends to drink water. Be kind.
and look after each other.
All right.
And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.